Hi, this is Rebecca from The Sauce, your favorite drunken culture and politics podcast. I hope you're enjoying a happy Yuletide season. Maya and I aren't recording over this holiday break, but we didn't want to leave you without any sauce to enjoy. So here's a collection of some moments from a previous episode that didn't make it into the final cut. These come from an episode we recorded around November 20th. We were talking about Me Too and the whole movement toward exposing sexual assault, where we wanted to see it go and where we were afraid it might go. Our conversation got off topic a little bit and went over long. So these moments didn't make it into the episode as posted. But I thought you might like to hear our thoughts on some topics that are tangentially related to Me Too. We'll be back soon with brand new episodes. In the meantime, enjoy and have a wonderful holiday season.
I've been thinking about how, like, is this our red pill moment?
right.
There's
right.
a way in which one of the things, this is from The Matrix,
yes.
You know, take the red pill or the blue pill. And one of the things that you see in a lot of the MRA culture, the sort of men's rights seduction community, like whatever, is this idea that, like, now that we're going to show you how gender works. We're going to show you how your power is. And so if you're willing to take the red pill, we're going to show it all to you. And I feel like for a lot of women, this is our red pill moment. Like, oh my God, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. And it's in the men that we love. It's in the men, some of the men that are closest to us are pigs like this.
Yeah.
It's the nice dad, you know, who's dropping off his kid at our school. He did this too. Like, oh shit, they're everywhere.
It's true. That would be the best, I think, outcome is if it does serve as a red pill moment, which makes me think how kind of ironic it is that red pillars are like a kind of subsection of MRAs, but the alt-right uses the term red pill to refer to people stopping being normies, which is what they call people who aren't fucking Nazis. And once then you get red pilled and you become one of them. And it is sort of funny to think about it that way because those are people who are using this analogy. The analogy is to The Matrix, where Neo takes the red pill and realizes that everything around him is a lie and everything he's been taught to think is real is not real. And it's all a front for he's being manipulated and basically he's a slave.
Right.
The people who most use that term to describe their moment of awakening are the people who've been awakened to the idea that men should dominate and, you know, women are too emotional. It's like, wait a minute. How is that shaking off the Matrix? Like your red pill is reinstantiating 5,000 years of conventional wisdom. It's not taking you to a new place, buddy.
That's right.
Okay. So where do we want this conversation to go? What would be the good direction for us to go now?
Right. Well, I think before we can say the good direction, unfortunately, we just have to briefly go through the places that we see it going where we're like, no.
Yeah.
Uh-uh. We're not, no, not feeling it. And I think that one of the things I wish we could prevent right now is the redemption tour.
Yeah. So one of my concerns, I'm with you on this, is that a certain amount of time elapses and then these men get redeemed, whether through statements of apology and demonstrations of contrition, or just like with Mel Gibson, just time goes by and then people are like, wait, what? Didn't he do something controversial? Whatever.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, Roman Polanski was convicted in a court of law of rape.
Let's be really specific. He was convicted in a court of law.
Yes.
Of drugging and then anally raping a 13-year-old girl. Let's be really clear about what it was. I mean, you don't get to be like, oh, maybe she looked older. Like,
right.
No, she was a child. He raped a child.
And he was convicted. So you can't even pull this like, well, if true, this is very bad, or innocent until proven guilty. It's like, nope. He's convicted and he is a fugitive of the law. And they have film festivals in his honor. Actors work with him. Other artists work with him gladly.
Right.
As if nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe we've come somewhere since that. But, yeah, I do worry about this idea that the apology just becomes sufficient. And then the men who did these acts just continue to have power and continue to dominate their respective industries and fields because they apologized, or maybe just time passes and they just, nothing really happens. They just, maybe they lay low for a while and then they come back and it's fine.
Right. Or they, I keep thinking about this moment when Richard Pryor did his stand-up show after he set himself on fire. And he comes back in and he's like, hey guys, like, I know you want me to do well and I can feel how much you want me to do well. Like, there's this way in which the redemption story is deeply, deeply embedded in our American culture. And it's deeply embedded in our specific version of American Christianity and American sort of like prosperity gospel Christianity, where it's mm-hmm. like, people do bad things and they sin and then they return. And mm-hmm. I mean, it is deeply, deeply embedded in the stories that we tell. Every VH1 special mm-hmm. about some band is like, they were young and talented. They started out and then they got more and more successful. And as they got more successful, they got out of control and there was sex and there was drugs. And then it hit some kind of bottom. Mm-hmm. And then we see them and they're like, yeah, I'm clean now and it's fine. In some ways, we're playing that narrative for Mel Gibson because he hasn't,
no.
you know, he had bottomed, but Jesus Christ, he hasn't apologized.
He never showed any contrition. He never apologized. He did. That's my point. He didn't even have to. We fill it in. The culture
yes.
fills in the,
yes,
the part where they repent, and they don't yes. even have to do that.
This comes to something that is part of something bigger that I'd like us to sort of consider as we're chewing through all of this, which is that there has been a very successful ideological and cultural project of the last 40 years. And I'd like to just take a second to tell a story, if just briefly. I was doing this project about the history of Atlanta, and I was constructing this big video installation out of just like dozens and dozens of clips of Atlanta history. So I was just watching all this stuff, tons of crazy shit. And I found this documentary that was called something like, Where Do We Go Now? It was like this social justice documentary from the 70s. And it was about the projects in Atlanta. And it was about the ways in which there isn't enough childcare. So what are these working moms to do? The housing is like this, so it doesn't allow the kids to live in this way. And it was talking about the systemic problems that were interfering with these people's ability to live a better life, to get better educations, to thrive. There's something that they talk about with babies, about like this baby has a failure to thrive. That certain environmental conditions can cause a failure to thrive. And that's what this documentary was. It was about like lack of affordable, good childcare, lack of good school systems, the fact that people have to live 2-hour bus rides from their jobs in substandard housing. Yeah.
Nutritional issues, lead paint prevalence, increased
yes.
asthma
yes.
rates. Like, I mean, I used to be a public school teacher. Like, I could talk about this stuff all day. But anyway,
right.
continue.
And stuff that we see yeah. the impact.
We know it's there.
And I realized, I had this crazy moment where I realized, oh my God, I haven't seen anything like this in years. why haven't I seen anything like this in years? And then I realized, because this film was made before Reagan, and I started to cry because I was like, oh my God, the Republicans have been so successful
yes.
at this ideological project of rejecting the ways in which a person's outcomes are determined by their environment,
right.
by like social factors, organic factors, historical factors, that this plays into what different people get to do, what people have access to. If a child is born and does not have access to nutrition, their brain will not develop in a certain way. If a woman who's a single mom does not have access to dependable, affordable health care, how can she work a job consistently? All of those things, like, we don't talk about that anymore. Yeah. And I feel like this is a moment where I'm really sort of vibrating with, how do we shift it back mm-hmm. away from that personal responsibility narrative?
I do think some of that shift has happened, has started. But I think it's really interesting point you make about Reaganism, because Title 10, for example, which funds family planning, right? It subsidizes birth control and other family planning for low-income women. Nixon signed that shit. Like, yes. Nixon is like your like cartoon villain conservative, but that guy actually signed several pieces of legislation that would be considered downright progressive by today's standards. Because indeed, Reaganism brought to the fore and just really cultivated this ideology of quote unquote personal responsibility. That flat out rejection of the idea that your outcomes might be affected by anything other than your personal choices and your personal like morality, because there's an inherent morality judgment in it, right? If your outcomes are good, it must mean that you've done right. You've made smart choices. You've made good choices. You've been responsible. You've been hardworking. Whereas if your outcomes are poor, that means that you've not been hardworking. You've been lazy and so forth. And I guess it's great because for them, it feeds into like trickle down economics and the idea that the people at the top of the food chain, the 1% and the 0.1%, must be there because they're the most hardworking and they've made the best choices, right? Like it's so self-serving. Of course, whenever there's failure, that's never the result of their choices. The failures are always socialized.
And I think that there's a real choose your own adventure moment in terms of how we see this.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we're saying people do make the best choices they can given the choices that they are given.
Yes.
So one thing that I'm seeing a lot of in a lot of these stories about sexual assault, and again, a lot of these stories about sexual assault that we've been seeing in the news, we're not seeing enough stories about, I mean, Barbara Ehrenreich wrote this, we're not seeing enough stories about maids, about people working in service professions, about women of color. Like, we're not seeing those stories.
Those stories have been out there, not in as great numbers as you would hope, for obvious reasons. You know, it's very difficult. The people you're talking about are in the most precarious positions. They're vulnerable and it's hardest for them to speak out. But even if they do, it doesn't get the media play because they're not necessarily accusing a big Hollywood or Washington DC power player.
And unless except for the like Dominique Kahn story, like that was at least that was a moment of hotel harassment where the target harasser was this like big deal French politician. But in all of this, I think one thing that in terms of reframing it, in terms of where do we want it to go, in terms of this more systemic understanding is, can we recognize that it's not that people are making bad choices? Can we say, what are the choices they're making based on what choices they're given? Like, these are the choices that they have. I have the choice to not say anything. Mm-hmm. And keep my head down. I have the choice to say something and possibly like risk my whole career. And I think that we're seeing all of these different women's stories as this sort of parade of the different adjustment of choices. I did tell something, the producers knew, and then nothing happened. And da 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 da. Like, and I think that that's an interesting way to keep fighting or where we want it to go is to have this bigger frame of what are the choices that a woman has in this situation.
Yeah. And this idea that choices are limitless and that everyone's in control of their own destiny is part of the sort of counter narrative that we're fighting against, because that's where people come in and act like, you know, there's always people out there saying, well, I would never let anyone do that to me. Or, well, if somebody harassed me, I'd just get a new job. This implication that it's on the victim of the harassment to take care of the situation, and that even if they can't, there's always something else they could have done. They could have spoken up sooner. They could have spoken up louder. They never handled it right, no matter what they did.
Right.
But that's the beauty of the personal responsibility, personal choices ideology, is if you don't like the outcome, you can always pinpoint the place where the personal choices went wrong.
That's right. We should have been in the generation that is over this shit.
Right.
But I see in a lot of my friends that they have become the facilitator for their male partner's success. And at no point did we go, wait a second, am I the facilitator for his success because he got more opportunities than me?
Right. It goes to this whole bigger question. It drives me nuts, the frameworks that we have to talk about this stuff, because it's like, we just got to respect all women's choices, and some women choose to like stay home and take care of kids, and some women choose to focus on their careers. Why do we talk about that, but in absence of these other factors that are limiting women's choices? Yes, some women choose to stay home and take care of the kids, which is great. Hashtag bless, whatever. It's wonderful. That's great. But if we're going to talk about that, we should honestly also talk about the real calculus that goes into those decisions, which isn't necessarily in every case, I, the person of feminine presentation, just inherently have a stronger desire to do this thing. There's all kinds of factors about like, is he making more? Who's making more? Who has better career prospects?
Oh, I have a whole theory about this, actually, because when I see all these women who are like well-educated, badass, genius, feminist, went to rad schools, like rad ladies, all of a sudden getting involved in the mommy wars. And I see it.
Yep.
I see it. I'm talking about like my community of women where I'm like, what is happening, guys? And I totally think that it's because the professional disappointments of their life, which I think are completely embedded in sexist things that have happened to them, make them go, my professional career didn't happen the way I wanted to. I'm going to put all of my like type A hardcore energy into being a mom. And so you see a lot of like these, you know, breastfeeding versus formula feeding and this kind of optimizing and trying to be like the best mom.
Yeah.
And there's this mommy list called the Booby Brigade, which is the Silver Lake Mommy's List, which is, you know, you can find a great doctor on there if you need to, but they get wrapped up sometimes in these like mommy war things. What I'm not seeing in it is, are you investing in this because things didn't happen in your professional life because of sexism? And my bigger theory is that a lot of the investment in this is because of the sort of Reagan Republican moral majority that, whether we like it or not, it has been so dominant in our culture that women, even who are like leftist liberals, like would never be a part of that, have absorbed that is our role to be successful in, that sort of backlash, anti-feminist, anti like 1970s feminist stuff has been in the water for so long that we do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've 100% heard women say that they grapple with that they grapple with this like, well, if I don't take time off work at least to stay home with the kids, people are going to say I'm a bad mom. People are going to say that I'm neglectful, that there's something wrong with me. So women feel like they have to, even the most progressive women, even the most feminist women sort of like feel like they have to, which is like, it's fucked up in all kinds of ways. But there's also the converse of that, which is that men feel like they can't, Men feel yes. like they or their masculinity would be questioned and that they would be made impotent if they left work to stay home with their kids.
But then there are also things that are crazy, like, I mean, I see the ways in which my husband at his workplace, they're trying to craft parental leave policies to not make that happen. Like to make it so that it's like whatever, whoever's the primary caregiver, regardless of gender,
right.
Or even if you're not the primary caregiver, you still get the certain amount. Like I see them trying to craft the policy for better outcomes. But the other thing that's interesting is that when you look at it in terms of academia, men who take leave end up using that leave to like work on their
right,
books.
Like they finish their dissertation.
Yeah, totally.
No, but that goes back to like the whole second shift thing.
Yeah. They make a list.
Yeah. When they make a list, it turns out that the women are doing more, or maybe they're splitting tasks equally, but like the men are doing the less difficult, less unpleasant tasks, and the women are doing the shittier tasks.
My favorite study is that when they had men and women make lists, the men would be like, I took the laundry out of the machine and then I folded the laundry. And then men's lists were like really specific about all the specific tasks that they did. And women were like, I cleaned the kitchen.
Yeah.
I did the like.
I did like, the laundry, like, yeah. Like,
so the lists were the same length, except that the women's list contained all like actual stuff.
That's amazing.